FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. The date is August 10th, 2016. And you probably often wonder how these bills in Congress come to be and how they get passed and why they get passed. And well, if you are curious about that, then you definitely want to hear from my next guest. Her name is Jennifer Briney. Her site is congressionaldish.com. And Jennifer, you have been doing this now going on your fourth year. That's for the uninitiated, two full Congresses just about. And you started out deciding you were on a mission. You were going to read every single bill that Congress produced, unlike most of your Congressmen and women who can't be bothered. They just let the leadership put the bills in front of them and they sign off on them. And hey, familiar with your show? I saw you get an award nomination at the Podcast Movement show this year, and it's really thrilling to have you on the show. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Hey,
yeah, the podcast started. It's funny that you say that, because that, with the congressman not reading their own bills, that was the realization that I had. I mean, I was so naive when I started this, because I realized that, you know, more people should pay attention to Congress, and I needed to start with myself because I knew nothing. So I decided to start a podcast where my experiment would be reading every bill in the House of Representatives. I just picked one branch. So I would read every bill in the House and do a podcast about what I found. And one of the big lessons I've learned in the last 4 years is that you can't read every bill that passes the House, because they're just too big. There's just too many. I mean, do nothing Congress is not accurate. There's actually a lot going on, but it's just so irresponsible the way it's done that there are bills passed all the time that congressmen don't know what's in them. And so I actually had to change the format of my podcast because I couldn't keep up anymore. It was breaking my soul.
Well,
but yeah, I discovered that you are right. These congressmen don't read these bills.
No.
And I've been confirmed now from congressmen and from their staffers that they don't read the bills. That's well known.
Some of them, there's a couple that read all of their bills. I don't remember their names now. But I would say, rather than read all of the bills introduced in one house or the other, it probably would be a better use of your time to read bills that are jointly introduced by both houses, because those actually might have a chance of getting passed. When they just get introduced into one house or the other, odds of, and this goes for state legislatures too, the odds of them actually getting passed aren't so great. When they get introduced in both houses, that means they've got juice behind them in the Senate and the House. That means that somebody, oops, lights are flickering here. We've got thunderstorms and lightning going on, but yeah, hey, you like that. But when they get introduced in both houses of the legislature, especially if they get introduced right around the same time, that means there's money behind that that bill, and it has a very good chance of going somewhere. Just one house, it's an iffy proposition. But tell us what you have learned from reading presumably what probably are thousands of bills. And I don't envy the task. I mean, I find it so boring, and the language is obtuse. It's deliberately not transparent. You have references to other bills, which refer to other bills. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's a Mobius strip of really legalese that means nothing to the uninitiated.
That's true. And actually, you brought up a really good distinction, which is that I didn't read the bills that were introduced, because there are thousands that are introduced every year. What I did is I read the bills that passed the House of Representatives.
Okay, I see.
So that was what I was trying to do, figuring that if it passed the House, it had a good chance in the Senate.
And what I
learned from doing that is that it's important to look at the bills that pass at least one branch, because, like, for instance, there was a bill that gutted an important part of Dodd-Frank. it basically killed the push-out rule that said that if you're going to have customer deposits, you can't be an investment bank. You have to put those in two completely separate things so that our deposits don't end up in the stock market with bankers, you know, playing with it. And so that was in Dodd-Frank. That got gutted in a must-sign funding bill, which was 2,000 pages long. They passed it in less than 3 days. And that's the thing. There are congressmen that do want to read all the bills, but when they're passed in that manner, they physically can't. So, you know, you can't get through 2,000 pages in 2.5 days. I've tried. Yeah. And so when it's passed like that, you get these little bills that look like they're dead. So if you look at that bill, which was literally written by Citigroup lobbyists, if you look at it right now online, it looks like it died and it didn't become law. But the same exact text was copied and put on a larger must-sign bill and did become law. So even these tracking tools that we have to see if legislation actually made into law, they're not really working because they're not looking into the larger funding bills at the end of the year to make sure that these little ones didn't get attached. And so that strategy is probably the thing that's really changed the way I see Congress and the way I'm going to cover it in the next Congress, because I'm seeing that so consistently year after year after year, that that is now how things are becoming law all at once, right between Thanksgiving and Christmas, almost every year.
So that's an interesting thing, because you see that a lot when you have must pass bills where the government's going to shut down, or the troops are going to be laid off because they aren't going to be paid, or whatever. There's a million of these must pass bills. You know, the states won't get paid. The FBI payroll won't be met. Right. There's a million of these must pass bills.
Or like, don't you care about the children? Like every time you hear those,
I've had three of them. I don't care about them anymore. Let them starve. I want the bill read and I want it analyzed. Okay.
Yeah.
Don't pass anything. Too. Let everything shut down, because this is where the mayhem happens. This is where the theft on a grand scale occurs, because they know the bill has to pass. And this is where they talk about clean bills. Well, there hasn't been a clean bill passed in the U.S., you know, Capitol since I was a child in diapers, I have to tell you. And I'm a lot older than you.
So. Well, I mean, when it comes to the funding bills, like I said, I've only done this for 4 years, but that does seem to be the case that in the general provisions, I mean, there's a bunch of different sections with general provisions, but that's where they hide the goodies.
In plain
the thing
sight.
Is, I don't think allowing the government to shut down is the solution. I think the solution is we need to be taking our responsibility for hiring and firing our congressmen much more seriously, so that when they do stuff like this, they pay a consequence.
And jailing them. I mean, a lot of this is just theft, right? I mean, we're talking about it's just theft. Their constituents are getting paid off, basically, they're getting a return on their campaign contributions. And then this congressman, if he happens to lose his election next time, and he's got, because he passed this bill, he's got guaranteed source of campaign contributions. He's got a guaranteed job on K Street in a lobbying firm, or his constituent is going to take care of him, whatever. These congressmen, they go to Washington to get rich. That's what it comes down to. And
some of them, some of them don't. Some of them, that's the thing. I hate to paint such a broad brush, because there are people in there trying really hard to do good, but I'm going to say that they're outnumbered, you know, 9 to 1.
Yeah, it's a fool's errand doing good in Washington. You know, that's doesn't happen much anymore. And
but that's in our power to change it. And that's the thing. Like, I understand being cynical, but at a certain point, we need to take responsibility for our own government. And sitting back and saying, well, they're all bums. Like, at a certain point, if we think it needs to be done better, we need to do better. We need to do better in voting, and we need to actually run. And at this point, there are so few people that feel like they have good ideas that are actually willing to take the time to try and get into Washington that until we're willing to actually go there ourselves and to pay attention to Congress and vote out the people that are doing us wrong. Because you're right. You know, these congressmen, they are going to get a job on K Street. Okay, fine. Bye-bye. But at least they're not in the position of making laws anymore. The problem we have right now is that so few of us are voting, that there are districts that they've been able to actually gerrymander based on how people have voted in the past that are considered safe districts. all that safe district stuff gets blown out of the water if the 40% of us that never vote but can, if we show up, we can change everything and we can do it quite quickly. That's why I did this podcast to begin with. We can change the entire House of Representatives every 2 years. Mm-hmm. We're just not. And so I'm doing this podcast not to just bitch about government, but hopefully to change it through our votes. I mean, the only way, if we get to the bad place, the only way that we can fix it at a certain point is with violence. Right now, our votes still do count. They're getting chipped away, but they still do count.
And so I would like to tell that to Bernie's supporters there. They really counted, didn't they?
No, but that's the Democratic Party. That's not our system. We don't have a two-party system. That is within the Democratic Party. Our system has not been used yet this year. So we don't have to vote for Democrats and Republicans, which is another thing I'm hoping that we wake up to. Those two don't control us. We just think they do.
Yeah, they're
so what
crime
we saw
families.
Was corruption with Democrats. Yeah. That was their system in their private club. Our system allows independents to run in every single state. I checked it and I even know how. I did a whole episode on it. So independents can run for the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. It varies in difficulty, but we can run that way. And now with the internet, we can run without money. And the first person to do it is going to show us the path. And I do think that it will happen. Mm-hmm. The question is, are we going to support that person when it becomes possible? You know, are we going to support Bernie? I mean, he's kind of old, but if he runs again in 4 years as an independent, will we stop voting only for Republicans and Democrats? That's why he voted in their corrupt, or he ran in that corrupt system to begin with. He was never a Democrat, but because we as voters are only voting Republican and Democrat, he felt he had to. So this, so much of this is in our hands.
Mm-hmm. Well,
sorry, totally ranted there.
Hey, but you know, I think you're a little idealistic, but I like it.
Totally.
But look, you know, unfortunately, from the near birth of the Republic, we've had two parties. You know, they varied in their names and their compositions, but they've been corrupt to the core from the beginning. It's just the power that they've been able to exert has been increasing over time. And you know, we're getting to the point where they're nothing more than crime families. There's this one called the Democrats and this other one called the Republicans. Whatever you want to call them, they're just crime families. And they're corrupt from the local level to the national level. But whatever you want to call them, they're crime families. And I think parties should just be banned and just made illegal. And that's the way to deal with it. Any political party should just be banned in the United States. I know First Amendment rights and all that, all wonderful and good.
Yeah, the right to assemble. That's an important one.
Yeah, but not as a political party. You shouldn't have it. The founding fathers never anticipated the rise of political parties. And that is where the problems began almost from the very beginning. Most of the problems of the United States have revolved around these political crime families from the get-go. And
we have
the Federalists and, you know, it's really started with them.
It's true that the political parties are definitely a problem, and the way that they, the Democrats and Republicans in particular, have rigged the rules so that political parties can collect enormous amounts of money. You know, that's what really gives them their power is the amount of cash that they have. And so I think it all really comes back to money and politics, because having a political party, I mean, really you, me, and a couple of friends could sit in a room and call it a political party, and banning that, I think, is a slope we don't want to go down. Plus, we do have our First Amendment rights, which I'm not willing to give away. But when you look at the Democrats and Republicans, what they've been able to do is rig the system in their favor. So on the presidential level, they took the debates away from the League of Women Voters, and now a cabal, really, called the Commission on Presidential Debates, that was created by leaders of the Republican and Democratic Party, and they've rigged the debate rules so that independents can't get in. So it's stuff like that where these two parties in particular have change the rules in their own benefits to create a two-party system. It doesn't have to be that way. And so until they actually solidify that and really, you know, have control over the whole system, which right now I don't think they do, I don't think that we're at the place where we have to go banning First Amendment rights. You know,
well,
like I think we can run outside the two-party system and prove that it's not needed. And that's what it's going to take. It's going to be someone proving that they can do it outside the Democrats and Republicans that finally opens the doors to others to have that courage.
Yeah, I just don't see that it's possible for anybody at the present time to run outside the political parties. And I think most countries, their problems are directly due to the political parties.
But that, when you say run, are you talking just about the presidency? Because it's
I'm saying
so
in most offices,
on the congressional level.
Most offices can't be elected to virtually any office. Even the local ones are extremely difficult. And I've encountered this in New York State, extremely difficult to win any office as an independent. Really hard. And maybe the internet has freed things up a bit, but we would just be better off as a country having no political parties, open primaries in every state, and no reference to any political party. And they have them in certain states. So, you know, just get rid of them. They've outlived their usefulness, if they ever had a usefulness, and that'll debate you on, but let's just get rid of them. But let's get back to your podcast, to what you're doing here with the bills. What is the worst bill that that you have ever seen come out of this Congress, Jennifer?
Out of this Congress, well, I mean,
out of any Congress, I mean, out of the Congress, what's the worst one you've seen?
I mean, I'm still really mad about that one I kind of told you about that eliminates the push-out rule.
Yeah, because that's kind of like a reimposition of Glass-Steagall on a very limited basis, mind you.
It was. Yeah, that's what they were kind of attempting to do.
That was Citibank's doing for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And to have something written by lobbyists, I mean, literally word for word, 85% of it was word for word written by Citigroup lobbyists. To have that not move in the Senate, get passed into law and must sign legislation that has huge repercussions. It basically allows the big banks to get bailouts again.
Yeah.
Because that the reason they got a bailout and they shouldn't have. I mean, we have the FDIC for a reason. And so they got these bailouts because they were able to gamble with our deposits. So to allow that again was just such clear corruption that I don't think I'll ever get over it. And then I'm also
I remember it well. Yep.
Okay. So, well, Financial Survival Network, I would imagine.
Citibank got rid of Glass-Steagall in the first place. Robert Rubin and I can't remember the other guy's name, but you know who I mean. During the Clinton, Larry Summers, during the Clinton administration, this was top of their list. Now, I will grant you that that Glass-Steagall was kind of getting frayed and chipped away around the edges, but they got rid of it. So it's only fitting that Citibank got rid of a minor little effort to re-implement Glass-Steagall. So shouldn't come
and
as a surprise.
And what's happening now as a result is that, you know, you watch the debates between Hillary and Bernie and he'll say, you know, we have to reinstate Glass-Steagall. We have to break up the big banks. And Hillary say, oh, well, we have Dodd-Frank. That's good enough. And it's like, I've watched it be dismantled piece by piece over the last 4 years. It's a shadow of what it once was. Not that it was very strong to begin with.
It was useless. Look, it should have never been passed, Dodd-Frank, because Countrywide Chris Dodd was one of the enablers of the financial crash of 08-09. And Barney Frank, you know, his boyfriend was a higher up in Fannie Mae. And every time there was an effort to try to rein in Fannie Mae, and there were a number of efforts, up the down payments, various things to make it less likely to become insolvent, he raged against it. And believe it or not, even when the Republicans were running the House of Representatives, he was a very powerful member of Congress, and he stopped most of it. So the idea that these two guys were going to put together a law that was going to stop another crash from happening was just never going to happen. And they created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is a total sham, which has just really done immeasurable damage. So this thing was pointless, should have never been passed in the first place, needed to, you know, Glass-Steagall back, as well as breaking up the too big to fail banks, getting rid of derivatives, period. Elimination of the entire derivative trade, which is getting ready to blow up again. So I understand you're being enraged at what Citibank did, but it's very minor in the scheme of things. But anyways, so
it was just more the manner of how it was done. And it it was so clearly corrupt. I mean, my research into who got paid for this and how much, it took me 2 seconds to figure out where the corruption came from. You know, it was, it was
Representative
Kevin Yoder. I'll go ahead and name names. Kevin Yoder of Kansas. He's the one who slipped it in, and he was getting all kinds of money from the financial industry and Citigroup included. So it's like when you see those clear connections between I did this favor for this industry that, oh, has given me hundreds of thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. It's just so clear what's going on. And that was just, that was one of those that, that one really opened my eyes. And then in this Congress, I'm pretty angry about them passing fast track for trade legislation, because international treaties should have a threshold of 2/3 of the Senate voting yes in order for them to become law, because these international treaties trump our laws. Right. And now we've renamed them trade agreements. They're still treaties. And because of this fast track legislation, it's only going to take 50% of the Senate voting yes for these trade agreements to be passed. And the thing that really upsets me about this is it's like, it's one thing to do it until the end of the Obama administration, but they granted fast track authority essentially until 2021. So they don't even know who the next president's going to be, but they give them this fast track authority to negotiate these trade agreements. And I just find it so irresponsible that Congress is abdicating their authority to be the ones to really, I mean, it's Congress's job to vote on whether or not these treaties are in our best interest. And they've really just handed that over to the presidency and made the bar so much lower for these treaties to become law. It's just, that one really upsets me. It's upset me too.
Yeah, they've abdicated their function as a check on the executive branch.
And, totally.
Well, this is nothing new. Anyway, Jennifer, just tell us where to find you and when we can expect your next podcast.
Well, you can find me at congressionaldish.com. Also, you're obviously listening to podcasts, and so I think I'm on every directory that there is at this point. But yeah, Congressional Dish, there's also a Congressional Dish app, because the thing is, I know that I'm a idealistic, naive young lady. And so...
The best kind.
I haven't been around that long, but that's what this podcast is. It's me trying to educate myself and bringing people along in the process. And what I do is I have show notes for every episode that are linking to every place I got my information from. So in the main part of the show, you can find out where I'm getting my information. You can fact check it yourself, and you can actually go further if you choose to. So, and I outline the bills that I talk about, linking to the individual provisions. So the show notes are the most valuable things I have, and those are on congressionaldish.com.
All right, congressionaldish.com. Check it out. As always, you will find a link to the site in the show notes to this show on financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Imagine that. Reading the bill. Who would have ever thought? And whatever happened to the days when bills were 10, 20 pages long and a person of average intelligence, of reasonable intellect, could actually read a bill and understand it? Well, gone are the days. And that's why you need services, websites like congressionaldish.com to kind of hash it out for you and really explain it to you in plain English. So you've got a chance at understanding what those Congress critters are really up to. Jennifer, thanks so much for coming on. Good luck on the site and keep us posted.
Thank you so much for having me. This was very fun.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.